This meeting of the House Transportation Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:01 p.m. on Tuesday, January 27th in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Stutes, Representative Garrett Nelson, Representative McCabe, Representative Mina, Representative St. Clair, Co-Chair Representative Carrick, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Eichheide. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting, and thank you for that. Before we begin, I would like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, as well as Chloe Miller from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Our committee aides are Meredith Trainer and staffer Griffin Sakail. Thank you for your help. Without you, this work is not possible. And that is so true. On today's agenda is a presentation on match funds and impact of vetoes on projects by the Department of Transportation Commissioner Ryan Anderson, Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith, and Department of Transportation Director Don Panone. Welcome to the House Transportation Commission Committee, Commissioner Anderson, Deputy Commissioner Keith and Mr. Panone. Please approach the dais, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. And then as you are getting ready, I just want to know, I tried to, for questions, you know, unless the presenters ask for them to wait at the end, I'll try to give, after each slide, my members a chance to ask questions. And my pattern is to give you a question and then two follow-ups. And then I like to move on to somebody else. So just try and create some expectations so you're not surprised. But we'll keep going unless it looks like time is running out.
Okay. Well, thank you, Co-Chair Eichheide, Co-Chair Carrick. Thank you for having us today at the House Transportation Committee. So for the record, my name is Ryan Anderson. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. When we were working through this presentation, one thing we heard was that when we presented to Labor and Commerce this past summer, our audio wasn't the best. And so we've got some slides in there that we wanted to go through again because they're important. It's important information that we're happy to go through again with this committee. And then we'll get into some of the discussions about the match and the STIP updates, which are a very much a focal point these days for us. So, yeah, we're working through those. So if that's okay, Co-Chair, I'll begin the presentation.
Please proceed.
Okay. The first slide is just this is our project delivery program review. And really, you can see, you know, we 148 projects. This was in 2025. This is talking about active construction. You know, big focus on bridges, pavement, new roads. You know, we have some realignments. One thing, you know, when we went through this last session, you know, it was made real clear to us the legislature's intent that DOT gets the projects out. And that was a big focus. That wasn't, you know, and so we worked hard with our teams to make sure that was understood and that's what we wanted to do. We put out a letter. This went to Senate Transportation Committee that really laid out what our goals were for the year. And so you can see in that chart before on the bottom right-hand corner, the fiscal year, where we had 22, 23, 24, 25. And then we have the contract awards amounts, contractor payments, our FHWA obligations, because these all are a little bit different in our world, the FAA obligations, and then we had our discretionary grant obligations as well. And so at the time, you know, we wanted to make real clear what they were from 22 to 24, and then what we were projecting for 2025, as, you know, we heard from a lot of different entities, the legislature, of that desire to get projects out. And so that's just how we framed it. For tools for the department, you know, we have the tentative advertised lists that are online where people can go to see the construction schedules. We have a current bid calendar, contract award status as well, just so those are all there for people to look at, and that's where this information comes from. Okay, so we had a phenomenal year in the federal fiscal year 2025. If you look at the overall contract awards, we were at $897 million. And if you go back to that previous chart, I mean, we were pretty close to what, you know, what we were shooting for in our goals. There's always this request for the regional breakdowns when we come to contract awards. And you know, these are construction contract awards on the street. And, you know, so for that breakdown, Northern Region had $369 million. Central Region had $365 million. And South Coast Region had $163 million. And then you can just see the chart that kind of breaks down the number of awards along with the total value of the awards from 2022 to 2025.
Question, Commissioner. Yep. Commissioner, so I'm looking at 2025, and you know, I see the Marine Highway System in the legend. I don't see anything on the Marine Highway System, you know, or anything that looks like that would be black. I think in the legend, I think that's black, dark blue. It's hard to tell on my paper copy.
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit. Yeah, there's the awards for the Marine Highway System primarily. Are through other funding sources for 2025. So this, you know, reflects the highway funds, the aviation funds, and whatnot.
Okay, thank you.
For contract awards. Okay, and then this slide, these are the funds that are obligated. And so the previous one was like contract awards, signed contracts to contractors. These are the funds that we secure in obligations, and there can be a difference, you know, because if we were to obligate funds in at the end of a federal fiscal year, the contract may not actually be signed till the following fiscal year because of that overlap. And so you can see, you know, over the course of time, we wanted to make sure people had a good time reference of our obligations. So from 2019 to 2025, again, we had our highest obligation year on record in 2025. And that's something... One thing there, and it's on the right-hand side, this is where we factor in our 183, I think it was 0.4 million August redistribution, which was a record August redistribution for the state of Alaska.
Commissioner, what can you just define that word obligated? At what point does a fund or dollars become obligated?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So when we're going through the project delivery processes, you know, we have to get the plans, you know, completed to a point that we can, an engineer stamps them. There's an estimate, the specifications, the environmental document is completed and certified. The land acquisition is completed and certified. The utilities, if there's any relocations, modifications, those are all, the agreements are in place with the utility companies. Everything's ready to go. So when, for example, the Federal Highways Administration gets our package, it shows that the project is truly shovel ready. Every element of that project is ready to go. So then we're allowed to secure the funds. And then once the funds are secured, then we go out to advertise and award contracts.
Thank you, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the Co-Chair, I just have a quick question. Were all of those requirements met for the Cascade Point that you awarded the contract on?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, so when we go through different processes for bidding, of course, the Cascade Point was state funds that were utilized. So the requirements are a little bit different. We used a method of contracting called design build, where we hire a contractor to actually design the project, and then they'll construct the project. And that's where, you know, different requirements are met. So some of these things, like the actual design, the plans and everything, they'll be completed now as we go forward. That wasn't a requirement to have completed in a design build project.
Follow up. Thank you. So, Commissioner, are you allowed to award a contract prior to the funds being appropriated?
Through co-chair.
By the legislature, I should add.
Through co-chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Well, we need to have the funds secured to award contracts.
One more follow-up. Being the legislature is the appropriating body, don't you need to have those funds appropriated by the legislature?
Through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, and so when we went forward with Cascade Point, it was subsequent to the contract. It was subsequent to the vetoes. And so that, for us, the funding was secured. Yeah, Director Pernone, you think that?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes, when we issue a contract, we do have an appropriation in place, and the Constitution requires the executive branch to have an appropriation to expend the funds. In Cascade Point specifically, we had the appropriation in hand. We had already had obligations and encumbrances against that appropriation, and then did a contract for the final amount for the design build contract.
One last comment, if I might. I promise I won't do this more than once.
I'm actually going to go to Representative Mina. I'm happy to come back. Okay. So I'm going to stay true to my general thing. Okay. So Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I should, through the Co-Chair, thank you for coming before the committee today. I know that 2024, we had a very small August redistribution. How did that impact the large award for August redistribution for 2025?
For the record, Don Pannone, Director of Program Management and Administration, through the chair, Representative Mina, August redistribution allows us to access the funds that are by formula kind of put into a federal savings account every year. So every year we get an apportionment through the formula, and then we get this authority to spend a portion of that. August redistribution gives us extra authority. And so in the prior year, having less in August redistribution, we didn't lose those funds. They did carry forward in that savings account and did create more there that we could get access to some degree in 2025.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So if we can flesh out the funding politics a little bit more, and I've been sort of subject to this with KGB Road a number of years ago when the Valley delegation upset Governor Walker and he removed $200 million from the KGB Road fund. So how is that accomplished? I mean, he didn't do it through a veto. He just basically stopped construction. So I think the Representative Stutes is getting at some of the politics surrounding Cascade Point, and I would submit that there are politics surrounding every single road that in project that you do to a certain extent. And I'm wondering how something like that for KGB Road, which delayed the project almost 8 years and five or six deaths, how could that happen? I know it's kind of outside when you were here, but mm-hmm. I'm maybe trying to get at a larger point here.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aishad, Representative McCabe. As we work through projects, I mean, it's important. I mean, from our perspective, we want undisrupted project delivery on projects because whenever, we've set goals and we're moving projects forward and then a funding change happens or something has changed from the outside moving in, you know, our engineers, our staff move and onto a different project and we see a delay. And I think that's some of what happened on KGB Road where we had to get it restarted again. To keep it moving forward. I know there's been, in the GEO bonds and other appropriations, there's been funds made for these projects. And depending on, a combination of factors of where they fit in the project delivery schedules and the right-of-way schedules and those types of things, just keeping them moving is really important. And our folks are always looking at that funding date, when construction funding could be available, and then they're working, hard to make those dates. So, anytime there's a disruption, it can be delay things.
Thanks. So, follow-up?
Yes.
So, bringing this back to Cascade Point, Cascade Point has been started and stopped a number of times, if I remember right, whether it be in the initial discussion and then the design, and then we stopped, and then we kind of started again. And this is the third time, I think, that we've started again, or maybe it's only the second. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but.
Through Co-Chair Aishad, Representative McCabe. Yeah, for Cascade Point, in 2023, the governor signed an MOA or an MOU with Gold Belt, and that really was recognizing that there was a joint benefit because we have the highway that ends, at 43 Mile Glacier Highway that, currently doesn't have any facilities there. Gold Belt is currently working on, you know, that bigger perspective with the mines in the area, and they actually have their own operations that are moving people and whatnot out to those areas. So working together, you know, between Gold Belt and DOT was really the thought that, hey, there's a good opportunity for the Alaska Marine Highway System in terms of a ferry route that would shorten ferry distances, reduce operating costs, but then also, you know, having this as an area that starts to be developed may provide more opportunities for others out there as well.
So for my final follow-up. So I guess the comment would be what we've always heard and what we know is that you build roads where you can and you use ferries where you can't. And I think that some of the two Alaska-class ferries were sort of designed based on maybe having that Cascade Point there, which is why we didn't originally put crew quarters on them, and then we had to spend millions and millions of dollars to put crew quarters on them because politics shut down the Cascade Point project. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheid, Representative McCabe. Yeah, I think even the Alaska Marine Highways Operations Board recognizes the benefit of shorter runs for the ferries. I think everyone recognizes the need to reduce operational costs when we can, because it's an expensive system to run, and that, you know, these types of endeavors where we, you know, have longer roads, shorter ferry routes, overall, you know, when you look at the system approach, you know, can have an impact at reducing costs. So, yeah, for sure, you know, this is something that, yeah.
Thanks.
And just to clarify, I just wanted to, you know, have three questions before I moved on to somebody else. It's not final. So, Co-Chair Carrick?
Thank you, through the co-chair. And thank you, Commissioner Anderson, so much for being here with us. We're neighbors back in Fairbanks, and I always like to remember that we come from the same place. And I do have some kind of critical questions, though, and I'm just a little confused, I guess. That last line of inquiry raises a couple questions. One, there was an assertion that the Cascade Point project had been sort of started and stopped over time. And I think interest in the project has waxed and waned at different points in time. But had the funds been obligated for Cascade Point prior to the governor's veto of the reappropriated funds?
Yeah. Well, Co-Chair Carrick, so since 2023, the department, we've spent about $4.5 million on the design work, the feasibility studies, you know, all that technical information that we need, environmental studies, to really get it to that point for the design build contract. And then once we got to that point where, you know, the engineers and the team say, hey, we're ready to go, then we start moving forward with the design build solicitation. I don't have the dates on the design build solicitation, but yeah, did you have those, Dom? Do you remember?
For the record, Dom Pannone, the design build, so we did have obligations against the appropriation. The balance of the appropriation was encumbered and obligated when we finalized the contract, which was before the vetoes and before the effective date of the bill in July 28th was when we finalized that design build.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And talk to me about how the design build is equivalent to an obligation on the project itself. Those seem like two different steps. So if you have funds obligated for the design build, does that mean as much as actually obligating funds towards the construction of the project? Feasibility studies are not the same thing as the actual project itself.
So for the record, and then I'll defer to our commissioner, we had a contract in place at that point. And once the contract is signed, the funds are encumbered and obligated. So had the funds not been vetoed, the reapprobe language would have referred to funds available, and there would have been no funds available because of the encumbrance and the contract obligation of the state. And I think the project encompasses all phases, which is several phases, design, right-of-way, and construction as well, and defer to the commissioner.
I think that's accurate. And sometimes we get wound up on the obligated terms. In the federal world, it's a little bit different than with the state funds. I think for the state funds, I mean, it's really that encumbrance that goes to the contract that secures the funds.
And I have one final follow-up.
Follow-up.
I'm making sure I hold to the same rules. I'm going to let that go just a little bit, but I am also curious about the statement that was made in the last line of inquiry that AMHOB recognizes the importance of shorter routes. But don't we have a letter of opposition from AMHOB on the Cascade Point project?
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick. Yeah, when I say that they recognize the importance of shortening routes, if you read the recent long-range plan that was approved, that statement is in there. It's not specific to Cascade Point. It's a long-range plan. And, yeah, they've definitely spoken against Cascade Point. I mean, there have been those statements out there for sure.
I have Representative Stutes and Representative St. Clair and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eyscheid. Representative Carrick hit my point, and my point was I know that I find this whole thing so interesting because I know that in previous AMHOB board meetings, and then I'm going to get off the Marine Highway System, but it was made pretty clear that there would be a collaborative effort and a consideration of the AMHOB board's position, of which did not happen. They were also told that this project would not move forward without having certain documents provided to them, which did not happen. So it's pretty disgusting to see the manner in which this Cascade Point is moving forward. Not necessarily that it's moving forward, but the manner in which it's moving forward is really disappointing to see that coming out of this administration. Thank you.
Representative St. Clair.
Through the co-chair, thank you, Commissioner. I have a question on funding. And you kind of explained it, but I want to take a little bit deeper of a dive. When money is allocated, and you're talking about encumbered, unencumbered, when you start a project and you send it out to bid, do you have those funds in hand, or are you still waiting for an appropriation or waiting for the state, the feds, whoever, to send you the money?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eyscheid, Representative St. Clair. It can depend on the type of funding program. So with the Federal Highway Administration, what we will do is we'll have all the documents certified, ready to go. We'll submit them. Then they approve them. We don't go out to bid until after everything's approved and the funding is secured and in place.
Okay.
For the Federal Aviation Administration, which is a grant-based program, we'll actually have all the documents together. We'll be working with the Federal Aviation Administration and getting their concurrence to go to bid, but we actually don't get the grant until we have the bid numbers and we actually have a real hard number to tell them this is the grant that we need. So, some of the different agencies do things differently.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, and through the chair, Commissioner. So just want to flesh out one minor point. The first year I was down here, we heard and passed a bill for design build, if I'm not mistaken. Prior to that, you couldn't do design build. Now it's actually in statute that you do design build. Is my memory correct?
Through Co-Chair Eyscheid, Representative McCabe, the bill that got passed was for a construction manager general contractor, the CMGC. That was the one that we got in statute. Design build's been around for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Looks like we got through all those questions. Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. The next slide shows our obligations and grants for airports. And so this is, it's important to look at the different modes of travel. Again, this was a record year for our airport program, $321 million. I mean, we had a good year last year in 2024 as well. But you can kind of see how those numbers roll out as well. I mean, overall, all of our programs are increasing, which is good news. Along with that comes inflation and everything else. But, we have strong aviation programs as well now, too.
I had a question. You referenced the bipartisan infrastructure law funds, says they continue to increase.
when do those funds run out or stop?
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit, this year we're going to be going through what's called surface transportation reauthorization. And so this is the year where it all gets renegotiated. So we're in the last year of our funding bill.
Thank you.
Okay, and then this slide, you know, we've been last session, you know, it was told to DOT to, you know, get all the projects out we could. That was made real clear. And one tool we used to do that is called advanced construction. And this is where we can begin projects under this authority, and then we can convert to federal funds later. So we watch these balances. This is all of our advanced construction balances since 2019. And you can see they go up and down a bit. You know, in 2024, we converted a fair amount and we paid them off. And that was, you know, some of the concern by the contractors at the time because of the work and whatnot. So just that demonstration of, you know, we do carry this balance. It does have its advantages in that, you know, if we have projects ready to go and they're shovel ready, you know, we can AC a project and not slow it down. And so you'll see us use it in various ways over time.
Commissioner, what are the disadvantages of using advanced construction?
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit, we have a balance, you know, that's hanging out there. And we have to pay it in the future. And so, yes, eventually those come due. And so we're always looking for those opportunities, you know, whether it's, you know, maybe there's opportune times where we can pay down the balance. One thing we were talking about was if the Alaska natural gas line comes to fruition, that maybe that's a good time because it's going to be hard to find workers, hard to find contractors. Maybe that balance is something that's beneficial to have because we could be paying that down, you know, when there's times when we just, you know, it would be tough to get the work done.
As a follow-up, it was shared last Thursday at this committee meeting that's like a credit card. And you said you have to pay down the balances. So is there a cost like a credit card? That was an analogy used, so I'm going to just put it out there. Mm-hmm. If I carry a balance on my credit card, there's a cost to me. The credit card company doesn't give me that short-term loan for free. So is there a cost to the state for having things on the AC balance, so to speak?
For the record, Don Pannone, Chair Eichheit, there's no charge assessed on the state from the Federal Highway Administration. If we carry expenses on that, they simply, when we request to convert, then reimburse us for any expenses. We just carry the expenses. There's no interest charge like a credit card assessed.
So, following my own rules, my final follow-up. So, I don't know how to phrase this. I'm trying to be creative. So, one of the things I could do if I had a credit card, a zero interest credit card, and if I was leaving, I could run up the balance, thinking somebody in the future could pay for that. Mm. Is that a risk? And I, you know, essentially, what I'm saying, could the current administration, you know, this sounds like a neat a tool in your toolbox, but could the current administration run up the AC credit card? That means it has to be paid off at some point and kind of encumber a future administration. Am I thinking crazy thoughts, or is that a thought that is somewhat rational?
Yeah, Chair Eichheit, I think what you're seeing from the department, I mean, total transparency on our AC balances. I mean, what you see in front of you. It's also included in our statewide transportation improvement program. We identify any AC authorizations that we're proposing. So it's not something that we can just go and decide, hey, this looks like a good project and we're going to go AC it. I mean, there is a process. You know, Fed Highways is involved in approvals and the whole thing. So it's not like that. Yeah.
Okay. Co-Chair Carrick?
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I also just last year became aware of AC and a little bit how this works, so I'm also still learning about this. But one thing that really strikes me is you had said that AC is really a great tool for project delivery on shovel-ready projects. And so I just have a a couple of questions. One is, in 2025, are all of these that we've either had from previous years or that we used AC for this last year shovel-ready projects, or do we have projects in our AC balance that are maybe not quite up to that same point that we're using AC for?
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick, we have to go through the same processes to AC a project. So it has to have all those certifications, just like if we weren't ACing. So there's no difference there. So it couldn't be a project that was half done or not quite there yet. These are all projects that are actively, they're expending construction dollars. So that's when you see the $576 million number there. I mean, those are projects on the street.
And just another follow-up.
Thank
you, through the co-chair. It also strikes me that if you're a contractor or an engineering firm, you might prefer to have real dollars as opposed to AC in an ideal world, because AC is potentially, you might not potentially get paid back in a timely fashion if it were AC and something went wrong. Has DOT in the past year had to ask any of our construction or design firms that we regularly work with to do projects kind of at risk of that potential to not receive the funds back for AC projects?
For the record, Dom Pannone, the department, using AC as the funding mechanism for a contract does not put the contractor at any additional risk. And since the state is subject to the same requirements as using the current year's apportionment dollars, there's virtually no risk to the state. So we haven't, from the contractor's perspective, our obligation to pay and pay timely is the same regardless of what mechanism the department uses.
I might have to think on that for a minute. I have another question, but I'm going to save it.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So is there a cap on AC funding, and what's the oldest project that's left? What's the bottom? How old is it? How aged is it?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, there's no cap in regulation or federal statute. Other departments, other state DOTs, some have multiple years worth of apportionment AC'd, some will go up to a year. And as far as the oldest projects, we cycle projects through, because once a project has completed construction, we do have a timeline to convert it. And so as we cycle projects through, that keeps the expenditures down on those authorizations. But we can provide the AC list to the committee if they'd like.
If I could,
yes, well. Yes, we would like that C list, please.
Yeah, I think one of the things with the tools and project delivery projects. So one thing to understand about the federal programs, we get contract authority over the year, and so like when we start out a year in October, we're not allowed to spend all of our apportionment for the year, our limitation for the year. And so over the year, you'll see these announcements come out where you get $100 million of contract authority or $200 million. So they give it to you in chunks. When we have an AC tool, you know, even within that year, we can AC the project. So if we're getting into, you know, February and it's a good time to bid projects, we can AC it, we can bid it, and then we can convert that in August. So there's a lot of different ways that, you know, we're kind of rolling with that. But those are some of the benefits to the AC tool.
I'm going to put myself in the queue before I call my co-chair. And we've obviously used more AC authority, if you would, over time. Why haven't we used it more in the past? If it's a tool, I'm just interested in that trend line. Can you explain that?
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichscheid. I think last year was a good example. I mean, there was a lot of pressure on the department. From the legislature, from the contracting community to get more work on the street. We recognize that since the pandemic, there has been a pretty dramatic increase in inflation and the cost of projects. And so in order for us to kind of keep up with that demand, you know, that was asked of us, you know, one of our tools was to AC projects. And so I think that's what you're seeing over the past few years is just that inflation pressure. The federal programs aren't increasing as fast as inflation and for the transportation needs that are out there.
Okay, thank you. That's a rational explanation. Co-Chair Carey?
Thank you. Through Co-Chair, I know we haven't quite gotten there yet, but I know that there's been some discussion about the match funds that the state would need to provide in order to receive our federal match don't technically have to come through till July 1st of this year, which is the middle of this year's construction season. So can AC be used as a tool to shore the gap for the early construction season? And if so, how, when you don't know for sure that we get that federal match back? Right. And so I guess that's the question I'm getting at is, how can we use AC if we aren't really, really sure that that federal money is going to come into our bank account?
For the record, Dom Pannone, through the co-chair to the co-chair, Carrick, when we advance, construct, and get authorization, we have to have the match at the time of advanced construction. So that is part of our match, our annual match request calculation is how many projects are we going to advance construct and what's the match requirement for those. So in regards to that July 1 timeline, we're looking at the match that we have today and the projects we intend to deliver either with apportioned funds or with advanced construction. So that's the mechanics of the funding.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So I missed the first part of this, but let me just ask, based on what you just said then, do you have the match funds for projects, any project that will take place after July 1st?
Yeah, for the record, Ryan Anderson, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, so when we got asked to look at the numbers and our, you know, our project delivery timelines for this year, what we found was we had enough match to get us through July 1. After July 1, we don't have enough match to finish the year with the projects that are currently, you know, programmed.
Follow up. Thank you. Do you see that as a potential problem being July through September seems to be part of your busy season? I mean, am I reading this correctly?
Yeah. Co-Chair Eichheit, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, so great question. Absolutely great question. The way, you know, in the project delivery world, so the projects that we're bidding now, you know, we obligated 2 months ago. And so there's that delay. So when we get to July 1 and we start looking at the projects that we are putting in for obligations in July 1, they're typically really late projects, August, September. Sometimes they get kicked out into the following year. So we're looking at all those things. But the reality is, based on what our engineers are telling us they can deliver, we haven't found any projects. We're still looking that you could move forward, that they would have all the requirements for certification before July 1 that would require more match. So when we look at our total program of projects right now, which requires more match, the amount that we can deliver by July 1, you know, we believe we have enough match to deliver all those projects that we're saying we can deliver before July 1.
Follow up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So the anticipation could possibly be then a short season? I mean, am I understanding this correctly? That without the match funds after July 1st, the department could end up having a short season due to lack of funding.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes, there could be less projects on the street. I wouldn't say a short season because all these other projects that have been obligated beforehand, they continue. That match is secured with the entire project. So when we obligate a project, we obligate the entire amount of match with that project.
Okay.
So then, yeah, so it's, but there would be less after July 1.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit.
Representative Carey, Co-Chair. Yeah.
Thank you, through the Co-Chair. So I'm getting what would happen prior to July 1st and what would happen for projects that begin after July 1st. Going back to the question of would we be asking contractors or design firms to potentially work at risk of not receiving funds, I don't know how this works if you've bid for a contract that lasts from May 20th, say, through September. And most of our very large projects are going to require the entire summer construction season. And if we use AC for that project up till July 1st, but we have the contract in place through September, we are asking those contractors and design firms to work at risk because we don't know for certain what happens between July 1st and September. So I respectfully don't understand the original answer to we wouldn't be asking them to work at risk when it sounds like if you have a full summer's construction project and a contractor working through that whole season, if they're relying on any part of the match funds, it seems like we are definitely asking them to do that.
For the record, Don Pannone, through the co-chair to co-chair Carrick, when you look at the sequence of awarding contracts, that's what we're looking at, is the contract values in sequence that we would award before July 1. When we award and enter into the contract, we do that with the full amount of funds in our account or the full AC authorization, and we encumber those funds so that the contractor and the contract is backed by the ability to pay. So those contractors are not at risk of us not being able to pay. That's the point at which we then look at the next sequence of projects going beyond July 1 and where's the match for those, as we need the full match for every contract we issue. And so we're looking at it as a sequence. Once we enter into the contract, that contract has the money to continue for the length of the contract.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Appreciate that. And then I guess my next question is, if you have for those very large projects that require the entire summer construction season and you do have guaranteed funds for the duration of that project, how does that then impact the smaller projects that might begin in the later construction season, part of the summer? And it sounds to me like not all is well here. We've got some work to do to ensure that you have the tools you need to have a full summer construction season. And if you have these projects that are fully expended, the larger ones, wouldn't the smaller projects then suffer, especially after July 1st?
Yeah, for the record, Ryan Anderson, co-chair Eichheit, co-chair Carrick. So what'll happen is, yeah, after July 1, we won't be able to award more contracts. So that is the problem. And so, you know, we can continue to award contracts through July 1. After that would stop without additional match.
Really fast follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the co-chair. The projects that you would obligate starting July 1st, though, would have to already be bid and agreed on before July 1st in order for the work to get done. So the problem actually begins before July 1st.
Yeah, co-chair Carrick, so when in the federal highway world, this is the majority of the funds. We obligate first, and then once we've secured the funds, then we bid them. So we wouldn't be able to obligate the funds, so we wouldn't be able to bid them. That's how that would sequence.
Rep. McCabe.
I'm good. Okay. Ask
Rep. Stutes.
So I'm going to ask a question respectfully because I don't know. Why wouldn't you just say that you need that match money as soon as you can get it so you can then secure the contracts that you need to award after July 1st rather than saying, gee, we don't need any money till July 1st because the money's not going to do you a lot of good this year for July, if you get it on July 1st, from what I think I'm hearing. So what really would help you out, as well as contractors, is ideally to get that money as soon as you can. It's what I think I'm hearing.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, I mean, the certainty is a good thing for the federal programs. I mean, we are working right now with the Federal Highway Administration. The one thing we hadn't brought up yet was August redistribution. And that, you know, we have to factor that in, which is an unknown. We don't know until August how much we would receive for that limitation. And that's more match requirements. So every year in the beginning, you know, we put our projections together for the total amount of match that we need. And then, you know, we work through the year. So, yeah, the certainty is a good thing. You know, we were asked, you know, how much would we need and when? And so, you know, when we went through the numbers, we had enough match to get us through July 1 based on our current project load.
Follow up. Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. So the sooner you got the $70 million, the sooner you would have the certainty of being able to move forward. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, the certainty is a good thing. Absolutely.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate it.
Representative McCabe.
Yeah, maybe you can help me. I'm hearing it a little bit different than Representative Stutes, actually. I'm saying that I'm hearing that you're good through for the 1st of July, so we don't need to pass a special. I mean, this is what we're all sort of dancing around, is are we going to have to pass a special appropriations, supplemental appropriations bill now, or can we wait till we normally do towards the end of the session in May, maybe, and still allow you to award contracts as you need to and allow all of our contractors? Will their issue, of course, is they got a different planning window than you do. You know, they have to import things and people and that sort of thing. So my point is, I think Representative Stutes said it, or maybe you said it, when. So what we're looking at, what we're talking about here is the timing. Do we need to put in a supplemental appropriations bill now, or can we wait till May? And if we wait till May, how bad will it affect our contractors?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative McCabe. When the governor submitted the supplemental for the match, that would be for July 1, and that works with our current project load. You know, provided we get the match on July 1, there wouldn't be any disruptions to the project workflow at this time.
Follow up. So the second part of that is, how about our contractors? You know, they're all sort of clamoring that they want to be able to plan. They want to plan in March for what they're going to do in August, say. So is it going to affect them if we wait until May to do the supplemental?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative McCabe. Yeah, understood. There's a lot of concern there. They're looking for certainty for their planning. I completely understand that. So I think from their planning perspective, yeah, it affects them.
Okay.
And the follow-up question to that I have is, I heard it helps them, but isn't there some real practical issues that contractors have to face that's more than help, it's economic? And what I'm not a contractor, but they have to hire a workforce. They have to develop bids. They have to look at materials. I guess I'll just phrase the question this way, because I don't want to talk about the fears people have. I just from your experience, would an earlier supplemental help our contractors do the job that we're asking them to do, which is bid on projects, make sure they have the personnel to complete the project, and then have the materials on hand to do it, you know, essentially to execute the projects? Is it just like it's nice to have it early but not need it, or does it actually create some efficiencies for the contractors?
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit. Yeah, from the mechanics of things and when funds would be available and cash flow perspectives, I mean, what we're projecting right now is July 1, you know, that's when additional projects are available that we would bid. that would utilize that that additional match. I hate to speak for the contractors. I mean, they do a great work for us. I mean, the things that they've done out in the West Coast storm and some of these things are just phenomenal. And so I completely understand their concerns about planning and having certainty in the program. That's always just an important piece of that. And so from that perspective, I can understand that desire to have, this as quick as possible. From the cash flow perspective and what we're seeing in our program and what we're, able to deliver this year, that's where the July 1 date came from.
Okay. I think it would be, useful to hear from the contractors early in our session to get their perspective and just to kind of flesh out these questions, because I think they're important questions. But thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. And this is just one slide. And for the record, Ryan Anderson, that talks a little bit about the inflation that we've experienced over the past years. And one thing just to note that when it comes to the highway world, that world has seen inflation above and beyond some of these other industries. And so, from what we've seen over the past 3 or 4 years, we feel like this is an accurate statement on the chart that's on the lower left, and that's the FHWA National Highway Construction Cost Index. There's still, folks trying to do an analysis of why that occurred, but that's definitely, something we're trying to factor in as we're putting future statewide transportation improvement programs together and understanding now what our capability and capacity is for the future as well.
Okay, please proceed.
And then this is one slide that was requested on forecasted contract awards. And so this is where we get into 2026. You can see, at the time this slide was developed, there were 91 projects planned for advertisement. We do a range of costs because that's how our engineers work. But, we're $670 million to $1.1 billion in value, 60 Highway, 19 Airport, 8 other infrastructure projects. And then the one thing that we have done, so that we've added a shovel-ready projects piece, because when we ran across this match challenge, we had a STIP that was out for public notice that had the full match in it. When we went to the final for STIP Amendment 2, we had to fiscally constrain 2026, and so we had to show the match. And so what we did was we said, okay, well, here are the projects that, are in the STIP, and then these are the ones that used to be that we had to push out because of the match. They become we'll call them shovel-ready projects. We direct our teams. You keep going. You don't stop, We just go like we're going to deliver them this year, and that's what you see there. So we're really projecting a $900 million to, $1.4 billion a year this year with a fully matched program.
Go ahead. Yep.
I'll let Director Pinone speak to this one.
For the record, Don Pinone. So we've been talking about all the lenses in which we view our program delivery metrics, which is contracts awarded, federal obligations, federal dollars we've captured. And a third lens is the actual expenditures, which could come from multiple years of appropriations. We look at how much was actually spent through the books of DOT in a year. And this shows the amount that was reimbursed to the contracting community and spent against contracts that flowed through DOT. The major programs, we organize by major program. So AMHS is the Alaska Marine Highway. DRER is our emergency type projects. FAPT is our federal airport projects. FHWY is our federal highway. GRNT is grants. That's a lot of FTA, Federal Transit Administration grants. Harbors is mostly the harbor matching grant fund projects. PFAC is public facilities. I'm kind of drawing a blank on a couple of these. SAPT is the state airports. SHWA is state-funded highway projects. FTA. G is FTA grants, another category. And then we have some exempt programs, which is everything else. So the expenditures overall went from $1.1 billion to almost $1.1, just under $1.1 billion between federal fiscal year 24 and 25. And those are a reflection of how many contracts we've awarded, mostly in that year or the year prior.
And why did the, I see the trend here, from federal fiscal year 23 to 24, it goes up, but then it goes down in federal fiscal year 25. So what explains that decrease?
Co-Chair Eichheit, great question. The program expenditures are a lagging indicator. So in the years where we reduced advanced construction, that would have been using our federal funds to pay down advanced construction, we might have had less contracts. And so the dip there is an artifact of those other metrics.
Thank you.
Right. So moving to slide 10, this is our fiscal outlook looking forward. Our investment overall across the state by our major programs. We are in STIP Amendment 2. We have a total revenue of $1.7 billion with FHWA programs at $966 million, our Federal Transit Administration. And then we also have discretionary grants where the department competes for those. Those are at varying match rates. And then our advanced construction. This reflects the current STIP Amendment, which was lowered after the match was reduced. Currently, we're going to have slides on the STIP in a couple slides forward talking about the next full STIP four-year that we're about to release and how the match implications are going to inform what's in that STIP. Co-Chair Eichheit, the next couple slides may be a little repetitive. It's going over the match, but I'll hit on some key points that... As this table here shows, where we started with the governor proposed for the fiscal year 26 and what was eventually enacted after the vetoes and what made it through the legislature, and that reduction of $58 million in our surface transportation and $9 million in our airport program, that reduction of match. We adjusted the STIP to reflect that, and the program implications, we've talked about project delivery, but to the federal funds, going back to advanced construction, without this match, one of the benefits of advanced construction is we can simply use our federal funds to pay down advanced construction. So that of course, reduces the throughput of new projects and new contracts on the street. So, again, the timing we've shared, our project delivery plan and our cash flow does get us to July 1, but there are other factors.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I asked this question, I think, last session at some point, but looking at this feels a little stressful to me as a legislator because I want to make sure we get you the tools you need to accomplish the match rate or the match. But do you have any comments on whether Alaska, by having this uncertainty for this period of time that we've had, is potentially putting ourselves at risk of jeopardizing our current 9-to-1 match rate, which we're one of the only states that has that, and it's a pretty sweetheart deal for us as Alaskans, but I wonder if the uncertainty in our process means we're putting ourselves at risk of...
It's a political question, but I am curious.
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick, for the record, Ryan Anderson. I haven't heard anything from USDOT or the federal administration on that regards. We are using more of varying match rates in our program. A lot of the Rural Ferry Program and some of those are 20%, and so you will see more of a mix from us. I haven't heard anything like that. This we're not a state that's unique in this challenge. you know, if you do some research, other states have been here as well. So.
Okay. For the record, Don Pannone, moving to slide 12. Again, maybe slightly repetitive, but this outlines, the department received or the legislature passed a bill that had substituted an already reduced match with appropriations from prior year federal highway match funds that we had already accounted for in our plan, roughly $11 million of prior match funds for highways, roughly $9 million for airports, and then over $30 million in other projects that were in flight, all of those of which were ultimately vetoed, those reappropriations. Subsequently, we've reduced our STIP and are working on a new STIP and have requested the reappropriation of the restoration of those funds in unrestricted general funds.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. When is the new STIP due?
For the record, Ryan Anderson. Through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yeah, it's coming out soon. Right now we're targeting February 13th for the public review draft. We're actually, we have documents that we've submitted to the Federal Highway Administration for some preliminary looks. There, you know, we still had recommendations from STIP Amendment 2 that we wanted to make sure that we had those all, you know, squared away. And so we're going through that process right now. We do intend to issue kind of a technical review in advance of that. So the MPOs and folks get that chance to make sure that all the numbers are lining up as they expect. So you will see some more things in advance of that, but right now it's February 13th for the public review draft.
Follow up. Thank you. When is it due federally?
Through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. It's not. So we'll have this presentation here shortly, but we're doing the rolling STIP. So we're not in that situation like we were 2 years ago where the STIP has an ending date. Our STIP right now is good through the end of 2027. Oh. So we're doing this in advance.
Perfect. Thank you. Appreciate that, Commissioner.
For the record, Don Pannone, and with the Chair's permission, the next two slides are repetitive, and I think we can move to slide 15 and start our presentation on the STIP.
Go ahead.
Okay, with that, we'll call Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith up.
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Yes, that was an excellent segue. Thank you to begin talking a little bit about what to expect for the federal fiscal year 26 to 29 statewide transportation improvement program. What you see on this slide 15 is just a breakout of primary events that pertain to the STIP going back to March 2024 when we had the currently active STIP, Federal Fiscal Year 24 to 27, approved by Federal Highways and Federal Transit Administration. From there, and the majority of members on this committee have participated in presentations on these topics, but there has been since two amendments from that original STIP. And throughout that process, we've been working with our federal agencies and MPOs on a lot of process improvements, working on our 3C, our coordination processes with the MPOs and other transportation partners, and trying to collectively identify the format of the STIP, the processes for project selection, our fiscal constraint tables, several things which we can break out in future slides. But identifying what we want this next upcoming STIP spanning 4 years of 26 to 29 to look like. So our team's been actively working on that over the past several months. I would say some pertinent dates to pay attention to go back to February 14th, which is when we issued the second amendment out for public review. That was during session. This would have been for a 30-day public comment period. And after, you know, again, a very successful public engagement period, we took those comments back and worked to incorporate those into what would have been submitted to our federal agencies. However, during that time, that is certainly when we had been the match changes in the reduced match amount had occurred, which then required the department to go back and reevaluate the projects within the STIP. In conversations with our federal agencies, they determined that we could not move forward with the existing state match amount listed, given that it was not appropriated, because at that point it was not considered to be available revenue. So we did need to go back after the public comment period had happened and ultimately defer approximately 25 projects, which you had seen in the approved version of STIP Amendment 2. So there were certainly a lot of changes that had been made in that second amendment compared to what the public had seen. And at that point, in order to meet our August redistribution goals, in order to obtain that $135 million in extra contract authority, we did need to issue that STIP Amendment 2 to Federal Highways and Federal Transit Administration. That being said, our solution to that was to honor our commitment of getting to the next four-year STIP as soon as possible. We had been talking about the rolling STIP concept, which means every 2 years at a minimum, we can come out with another four-year window. And in doing so, at this time, it'll allow the public and all interested parties to be able to look at our project lists, the projects that were deferred, and then begin to take a fresh look at that prioritization of projects, because clearly there are far too many priorities for what we have funding for, and we didn't want that to be done in a vacuum. We did the best with our data and our project teams to inform the decisions about the projects for this construction season. But this next four-year window of the STIP, which will go out for 45 days for public comment, it will be that opportunity to look again at the next 4 years and make those decisions moving forward.
Okay. Co-chair Carrick?
Thank you. Through the co-chair, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for also being here. I really like the rolling STIP. I like what it will do for the department, and it sounds like it creates a lot greater efficiency and certainty for everybody involved. But the timeline here is a little interesting to me, because last year we had a lot of challenges getting that STIP approval completed, and the process was difficult for us. I know we haven't gotten to it, but I see a couple slides later we have the federal highway recommendation was to use plain English, clearer structure, limit to true project changes, clearly show what changed after public review, just a lot of like technical things that Federal Highways is asking state DOT to do better. And I know we moved to this rolling STIP process just right subsequent to having a lot of those challenges with the STIP last year. So can you talk to me about implementation of the rolling STIP, and with this slightly more complicated but ultimately efficient procedure, how are we going to minimize the inefficiencies we saw last year?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Co-Chair Carrick. One of the beautiful parts about this rolling STIP is that it actually doesn't change our processes. It only makes it occur more frequently and offer more opportunities for public engagement and formal transportation partner dialogue with every step along the way. It's just that it happens more frequently. And so to respond to the comment about our findings, yeah, we absolutely have been incorporating those, and that is what the public will see going into this public comment version of the STIP. But each time we do a new iteration of it, whether it's an amendment or a new STIP, it gives us that opportunity to continually improve upon that format. And if there's any new changes or new things of significance or findings, you know, we'll be sure to include those as well. Some of the topics, for example, like the formatting of the STIP, we're still unsure, even as partners with Federal Highways, Federal Transit ourselves, what that should look like. A lot of people have different ways of digesting information, And so to agree on a format that everyone is happy with, you know, we're still working there, to be honest. In this next step, we do have a substantially changed narrative. And to get to that more simple language, we've taken that and revamped our entire narrative document, which hopefully gets us there to a document that's more, has still all the substantial information that's needed, but is a bit more straightforward to follow, less about DOT processes, but makes it clear to the public what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick follow-up. And just remind me, I don't fully remember, but when we were talking about the STIP last year, Federal Highways hadn't significantly changed their processes for how STIPs are reviewed and approved. So what changed within our structure that made it such a challenge last year? And can you, I guess, elaborate a little more? How does the rolling STIP change the way we approach creation of that STIP document each year?
Yeah. So Co-Chair Carrick, one thing I will say is that in federal fiscal year 25, we actually had fantastic improvements in our dialogue with Federal Highways and Federal Transit. We had very fast approval of STIP Amendment 2, and the way that we needed to get there was through very frequent ongoing preliminary meetings with those agencies on all sorts of different topics, from fiscal constraint to our public engagement to formats. And so in order to get to what was a very fast approval, it was a matter of a couple weeks before we had it. There was so much preliminary work that had been done that it got us there very quickly. But there certainly had been a lot of changes within even our own Alaska office that, you know, everyone's been navigating. So we're moving that into this next four-year STIP. Commissioner Anderson had mentioned that we're going to be issuing a pre-release version of the STIP. And this is something we're very excited about, because the idea is that we're going to have a publicly available version of our full STIP. We'll put it out for a 10-day agency review. We've had a lot of feedback that, you know, we have a STIP that people don't feel they've had the opportunity to engage prior to going to public comment, especially our MPO partners. So this allows them to look at our STIP, the same document that everybody has seen, including the public, and be able to look at the fiscal constraint, the projects, make sure the projects that they have are included in those tables, Federal Highways and Federal Transit, Western Federal Lands, Highways Division, BIA, all of these that rely on our STIP to be technically accurate will be able to look at the document, give us feedback, and then we can include that, incorporate it prior to the public comment period. So ideally, this is going to minimize, you know, any technical corrections, things that could otherwise confuse people when doing a deep dive on our STIP, and get that done ahead of time, so then it's a much more integrated, accurate document for the public. So this, we hope, will alleviate some of the problems we've had going through public comment and having a significant number of changes following that. So,
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, I'd like to just say that I appreciate your willingness to take the burden of or the entire responsibility for the STIP failure, if you will, in 2024 onto your department and try to fix as much as you can. But for the record, I'd like to say that it was not all your fault. A lot of that came from misunderstandings from various MPOs. A lot of that was politically driven by the Moncho mine and the trucking thing, which made a bunch of people angry. A lot of it was driven by politics. And I appreciate that the Federal Highway Administration is now a full-blown partner, and that you have taken the time and the effort to take all of this mantle on your department and fix whatever you can and establish a dialogue with the MPOs. So it's noticeable, and I, for one, appreciate it.
Yes, yeah. Commissioner Anderson.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aisha, if I could just speak to Mr. McCabe's, Representative McCabe's comments.
You know, well, we're I mean, there was a lot of noise about the step, and there's no doubt. And there was a lot that went on where we worked really hard. We went to Washington, D.C. We thought, hey, things aren't happening like they used to. We're not getting good answers. And we won some things there. But ultimately, you look at the results, and if you looked at those timelines from the graphs that we showed before, every year we're obligating the entire program. Every year we're getting more than what our apportionment is. You know, we got scrutinized last year because it was only $20 million more. That was the year before last. Sorry, last year we did the record $184 million. I mean, I'm really proud of our teams. I just got to say that. I mean, they've been through thick and thin on this thing, and they've come through, and they've really, you know, everyone's taken this as a way to, you know, we want to do the best for the state of Alaska and move forward that way. So, I mean, just we stay focused on the results. Lots of noise. We stay focused on the results, and that's what you're going to see from us for sure. So, thank you.
And then I was curious about the genesis of the rolling step idea. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit, when we began after the STIP was initially approved, the 24 to 27 Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, our teams had reviewed best practices at length of other states. There's been research documents that exist about best practices. We've talked to other states when we engage at transportation conferences. So from that, we had heard several states put out a rolling STIP and, you know, began to understand that that would likely help us both future-proof our STIP so that we don't get into a bind with our STIP running out of time and potentially delaying projects. And it just seemed to have numerous benefits, so through best practices of other states.
I just, mm-hmm. You know, for the record, I really appreciate the concept seems sound, and I appreciate, you know, borrowing ideas from mm-hmm. other places and reaching out. So, you know, good job on that. It just, you know, Commissioner Anderson.
Yeah, Co-Chair Eichheit. Yeah, and I just also like to mention, we should have mentioned this earlier, the state of Alaska won a national award for the development of how we've changed and the way we do our STIP now. It was from the American Association mm-hmm. of State Highway Transportation Officials. Those are the folks that, you know, on the federal highway world, that's the big, you know, organization where all the states come together and look at new ideas and how things work. So that was a big honor for us, and it's something, yeah, I think just another thing we're constantly trying to do better.
Congratulations. Thank you for sharing that.
Yep.
So for the record, Catherine Keith, slide 16 talks a little bit more about the developmental process of a statewide transportation improvement program and specifically the rolling STIP. And I think we've talked a lot about these concepts, but just for awareness right now, that what we've been doing over the past few months is looking at all of our cost estimates. Every time before we issue a new STIP, we require that we have cost estimates, any changes to scope, schedules, and those budgets come in, and we include that into the next STIP, which certainly is largely what requires a substantial number of changes just because the project delivery is very dynamic program. We also look at project eligibility to see how we can take advantage of new funding opportunities to make the funds go further, to do more with it. And it's our opportunity to reevaluate priorities. So if there's any questions on the development, happy to answer that. Slide 17 talks through what those recommendations have been from Federal Highways and Federal Transit Administration. And these are great guidelines, and they've been principles as we've been developing documents for a transportation program. We do have a 10-year plan internally that looks at all of our project needs across all modes. That's been put together by our staff to help look at where we're at over the next 10 years, where we may be overprogrammed, and to be sure that we're incorporating our asset management into our 10-year plan. That's something we do look forward to making available to the public at this time. It's been an organizing and guiding document as we move forward with projects in the next 4-year time horizon. but we certainly wanted to simplify it, which you will see in the narrative. The project pages that we've seen in prior versions, those are staying the same. We didn't want to create too many changes from what has been used in the past. So those same pages will be used, so it doesn't have to be an entirely new experience for people that have been working within the STIP. We have been talking to them about how to streamline future amendments, where one of the comments co-chair Carrick had mentioned was that they wanted to see a reduced number of changes in an amendment versus the all of our projects. And we're struggling with how to do that in a way that doesn't create confusion for anybody that looks at our document. It's very nice to have one comprehensive document that has all of the current latest information on projects. But we're still having conversations on this. And by the time we have our next amendment out, we'll have an agreed upon format for how we describe project changes as we move forward with other amendments.
So a question I had about that first one, my co-chair had mentioned this, you know, recommendation to use plain English and a clear structure. So one of the things I'm always concerned about, having worked in education and planning, and now my service here as a representative, is jargon and, you know, writing that is not super clear. So will the department use artificial intelligence to meet this goal of using plain English? I'm sure it can do it as long as you ground truth it. Is that a thing?
Yeah, excellent question. Thanks, Co-Chair Eichheid. Yeah, we will absolutely be using artificial intelligence in different ways. One way would be running, you know, a filter across all of the documents and make sure that we're writing at an appropriate level and that all the acronyms are spelled out, for example, and that we have consistent use. A lot of times that's what can create confusion in a document, is just multiple definitions and some inaccuracies. So it helps with that. It also has been helping identify errors. If we have any programming errors where maybe we're missing a project phase, or there's numbers that don't add up, or, you know, there's things that don't make sense. And that's been another way that we've been using it. But yeah, I would say it's been no secret that we're advocates of using artificial intelligence to help us with error prevention and other things everywhere it makes sense. It's not writing the narrative in itself, though.
Yes, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I think AI has some great potential. I'm a technology person, but I've never used it myself other than just kind of playing with it. But I've never used it in my professional work. Yeah. So, but, yeah, thank you for that.
So from here, I think we can touch on a couple topics about advanced construction and toll credits, just because a large majority of the conversation right now has been about the match. So I want to clarify how we're treating the match amounts in the next four-year STIP, because as of this time, there is not an additional appropriation for the remainder of the match needed for the program. So for this STIP, we have to move forward with the original amount with our expected state match. We're in order to get our full program obligated, we'll be leveraging our ability to use toll credits, which means we can use federal funds instead of state match on certain projects. So all of our marine highway projects with vessels or ferry terminals, we're leveraging that so we can keep those projects on track. And then we will be using our conversion, advanced construction conversions, to pay down those so-called credit cards when we do advanced construct projects. Because when we pay that back, it does not require match. So we can meet our entire program obligation without as is, but we to keep our construction program intact as we all want it. When we go, we'll need to have an amendment to this STIP once we have resolution on that. So that'll be the process, is we're going to put out our STIP for public comment. As we have resolution on the remaining match amount, we would put together an amendment and then be able to act on the additional match as it's available.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Through the co-chair, that very last statement concerns me greatly, because I think one of the things you had just said was the Federal Highways asked us to do fewer things in the amendment process in the future, and with the uncertainty around the match for the legislature right now, are we concerned about Federal Highways having issues with making a ton of amendments around the July 1st timeframe in response to receiving federal match dollars?
Through co-chair Eichheit, co-chair Carrick, we have talked with them about this and how they would like to proceed, and that's been an agreed upon format, is let's get a STIP out so that we can review all of the projects, look at eligibilities, work through priorities. But then when we do have updated match availability, then to go through this amendment process. We feel we can do this without creating a lot of confusion, in part by having a inclusion. This, we're still, to be honest, coming up with a format that we think will work without creating undue confusion, but we would like to have a list of projects and programs that with that available match would then be included in the next amendment. So if match is available, then this would be the change that we would see in the STIP itself. So in essence, you know, we could pre-review also what that amendment may look like to help give access to more information.
Follow-up?
Yeah. Follow-up?
Thank you for that, through the co-chair. I'm really concerned by that, though, because certainty is valuable, and here we have been all sitting at this committee table in this building thinking the federal match is really important for this summer's construction season. But what I'm hearing is, even though the department will undertake some creative solutions in the event that it doesn't happen, we will still need that certainty, not just for this year's construction season, but for the rolling STIP, which now affects multiple years going forward. So would it be a fair statement to say that the certainty of the legislature appropriating those funds early is better than late certainty regarding the STIP as well?
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick, it's a good question, because we've been brainstorming that ourselves as well. When should we release the STIP for public comment? Is it better to wait until we have resolution? And our concern is that we'll end up delaying projects because we don't have a new approved STIP in place, which is needed for changes to costs. So certainly having an awareness of what the match amounts will be would prevent some rework that would occur in a second amendment, without a doubt. But we will absolutely just be able to, we can still get there if we don't have that certainty. Yes, that's all. We have a couple plans so that we can ensure that we don't have delays in delivery, but it's hard to wait until we have that resolution, when we could at least put projects out for the public, and then there's perhaps more information for everybody to have a discussion and decision making on.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Were you in the queue before? Yes. I wasn't sure if I'd seen you.
Yes.
Okay. No. Representative Stutes and then Representative McKinney. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So just to be clear, this amendment would be dependent on the $70 million that is in question for match funds. Is that correct?
We can move forward. Oh. Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes. Yeah, we will be able to put out our first STIP out for public comment for that 4 years. If nothing else changes, that would be the approved STIP. If there is a change to the match amount that's available for this construction season, we would go out for an amendment. Yes.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
So just to be clear, if you were to receive an additional match money, that is what would prompt the amendment.
Yes.
Thank you.
Through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Stutes. Yes, correct. Yeah.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So interested in the rolling STIP. So you're putting out a Deputy Commissioner, you're putting out a STIP, a 4-year STIP every 2 years. So you're sort of overlapping. So an amendment, at some point, amendments won't really be necessary. They can kind of be bumped to the next STIP, right? I assume the STIP that's put out in 2026 is going to go through 2030. And then if there are amendments needed, then and they're not real critical, they could be in the 2028 STIP that'll go through 2032 instead of a big amendment. It seems to me, if I remember right, that was kind of what Federal Highways, hey, if you're doing a rolling STIP, you're not going to need huge amounts of amendments.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheid, Representative McCabe, that would be fantastic. We would love to not have to do all of the amendments. That being said, there are some states that put them out every other week. There's a new amendment.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of work for sure. Unfortunately, there's a lot of factors that require us to go out for an amendment. It could be an increased dollar amount. If there's a price cost escalation above a certain threshold, say 20% of what we have, the only way to move forward with the project is through an amendment. But our goal would be to have minimal changes in these amendments as we move forward because we're updating things more frequently.
Follow up. Mm-hmm.
So I remember from a couple of years ago, Federal Highways was sort of holding us to their regulations, I guess, or their procedures in the lower 48, which has an extended construction season where, say, a contractor runs into a big frozen pile of permafrost or clay or something, and it's going to take a pile of money to to dig it out, because you obviously have to dig it out and replace it. Then at the time, the Federal Highway Administration was saying, well, that's a huge amendment. We're not just going to give you the money. You need to go out for an amendment, which meant a 30-day comment period and all that. So has that sort of changed? Have they sort of relaxed that requirement and got back to maybe understanding that Alaska construction is a bit different than the rest of the country?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Representative McCabe, yeah, great memory. That procedure is still in place in our currently approved STIP narrative. And just for context, it specifically relates to a project that goes out to bid, and when a bid comes back higher than what we had obligated and expected, then we cannot award that contract until we have a STIP amendment out, which was a significant problem for us, and it has delayed. One project example would be in Haines, where that created a delay by an entire construction year. We are proposing in this narrative with our procedures to go back to our original version of that, which gave us the flexibility to do a increase and move forward toward that contract without a STIP amendment if that was in the best interest of the state.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
So, yeah, just a comment. If I remember right, the problem was the timing. Yeah. So if you suddenly have this big issue that you didn't know about because it was underground, obviously, you got to do a STIP amendment, which takes time, 30 days. Then you got to do a 30-day comment period, which takes 30 days. And so by the time all that is done, your construction season could be over. I think that's Haines is exactly what I was thinking of as well. I think that's the issue that we're running into, and it would be really great if we could find a way to bring Federal Highways around to our way of thinking with that.
Yeah.
Comment more than anything. Thanks.
Good comment. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheid. Through the Co-Chair, my apologies for missing the middle part of the presentation. I had a bill hearing, so I'm just catching up. So it's not related to this slide, but I did want to ask, how does the use of the advanced construction impact the requirement for the STIP to be fiscally constrained?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheid, Representative Mina, with advanced construction, the fiscal constraint requirements certainly change. When we have to be fiscally constrained, we know the revenue that we have coming in on an annual basis, and that's all we program to. We can't over-program. But advanced construction is outside of that. So if we need to have projects move forward that, you know, it's $100 million over what we have revenue for example, we can program that as long as we have the match that's needed for those federal funds. That being said, the fiscal constraint that Federal Highways likes to see that they require is when we're going to pay it back. So on our STIP pages, you'll see what year and the amount that we will be paying back. So that's how they determine fiscal constraint, is to look at future years, and they want to guarantee that we can pay it back, that we're not getting over our heads with our commitments on advanced construction. So, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. for the record, Ryan Anderson, and apologies, we're working. There's a snowstorm in Anchorage, so I've been a little bit distracted here. So this slide is the Alaska Statewide Transportation Improvement Plan. It's really about the projects that we see now and how the costs are increasing. You know, we have more $100 million projects than we've had in the past, and you can see it's not any one type of project. It's not any one area. It's across the state. It really just reflects, you know, the needs of our state. I mean, these are good, solid majority of these are, you know, repair the road, reconstruct the road. We're not doing, there's not a lot here on new roads. West of Sitna Access is a new road. But, you know, there's good safety corridor improvement projects just across the board. But one of the challenges ahead of us are, yeah, I think these highway corridor projects we're starting to see, you know, you can be going 10 to 20 miles and the project's starting to push $100 million. And these are projects that have been around for some time. And then, of course, we also have a list of projects that greater than $250 million. So we're kind of getting this new category as well. So one thing, you know, you're going to see as we work through this new STIP is just, you know, how do we address these as the state? You know, we are trying to leverage all the tools that we have. You'll see a lot of things where we're breaking up projects into smaller chunks, you know, so we can afford them. And just across the board, we're looking at, you know, any type of grant opportunities, whatever there is out there to help with, you know, the funding of these projects. So just to give everyone a sense of that. I thought it was important.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Through the Co-Chair, I was looking at some of these projects, and I know a lot of my constituents, they're really concerned about safer Seward Highway. So I wanted to clarify that Seward Highway milepost, that safety corridor, is that part of the safer Seward Highway project?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aisha, Representative Mina. Yeah, the Seward Highway milepost 98.5 to 112 is the safety corridor project. That's the one that goes along Turnagain Arm to Girdwood. Yeah, that's that project.
Follow up.
And just to follow up, through the co-chair, I know that there's been a lot of local advocacy to our MPO, to AMATS, about safer Seward Highway, and that the projects that are in the STIP need to also be in our MTP. Are these projects also in every MPO's respective MTP, including safer Seward Highway?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aishad, Representative Mina. The requirement is if a project is within a metropolitan planning area, that then it has to be in the MTP as well as the MPO. I'm going to use way too many acronyms now, as you had mentioned, the metropolitan planning area, and then the metropolitan planning organization, transportation improvement program. So those are the requirements, and that's something that we went through. That was actually something that we didn't used to do back when we had the new STIP. That was something that was a change in interpretation from the Federal Highway Administration. So now we are doing that. The Safer Seward Highway in particular, that termini from 98.5 to 112 doesn't enter into the MPA. So you'll see that in the state of Alaska's statewide transportation improvement program and not in the Metropolitan Planning Organization transportation improvement program.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I know we're looking at a slide that says statewide transportation improvement plan, but at this point we're also kind of talking about big picture projects in Alaska, and I'd be remiss if I didn't go all the way back to the beginning of this presentation just for a second and just return to the Cascade Point project regarding the match. And I guess the question I have is, why, if we are short on our match, are we pursuing in just its design build early phase on Cascade Point, that project, why is it taking precedence, seemingly, this is the public perception at least, why is it taking precedence over, say, Anchorage safety projects that were part of that metropolitan planning process and are highly needed and demonstrated? You know, talk me through how, I know we're not comparing apples to apples per se, but talk me through how that works. Because currently Cascade Point seems to just be a bridge into a forest. And we're in this design build phase, but it feels like it's taking precedence over critical safety projects, pedestrian safety projects in Anchorage. So talk to me about how I'm misinterpreting that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick. When we look at kind of that realm of projects for a year, and so you'll see, you know, so last year we secured, I think it's around $1.3 billion. I mean, all those projects are priorities. I mean, everyone here has projects in their districts that are priorities. We're looking at it from project delivery perspective. You know, we've got the permits, we've got the right-of-way. Okay, that project's ready to go. That moves it up in the priority list. And so when we're looking through those things, you know, that's really, when you look at the statewide transportation improvement program, the majority of the changes are either due to cost increases or, you know, there was a right-of-way that was going to take some time longer, so it got pushed out to another year, mechanics like that. So once we have these projects, you know, internally we're managing resources and we're shifting things like that to get the projects, you know, moving forward. We're not, you know, necessarily saying, well, that's our favorite project, so, you know, that's, you know, and then there's the list of funding types, you know, and which funds fit where. The Anchorage safety projects, for example, there was a set of those projects for the Highway Safety Improvement Program, which, you know, we recognized when we initially, you know, made some changes there that, okay, that's an area that the mayor of Anchorage folks came to us and said, this is really important to us. And so we went back and we're reallocating resources so that we can get those projects across the finish line. You know, we'll pull in from other areas and work those things. But there's always that balance. So, but what we're looking for is project delivery. And, you know, last year there was a lot of pressure putting on the department that get the projects out the door to contractors. We took everything we had. We got it out the door. And that's what you see in our numbers from last year.
Just a follow-up.
Thank
you, Commissioner. I'm not a transportation safety planner, and I'm not in your shoes, but I will just, I guess, reiterate what's been said in some other committees, that to the public right now, it doesn't necessarily feel like the balance of their public input and what projects we go forward with as a state is necessarily aligning. And that's not to say that the public is always right about what the best, most feasible shovel-ready project is, but it sounded to me from a Fairbanks perspective outside of Southeast and Anchorage, like we had Anchorage projects that were a lot closer to the ready-to-go spot than Cascade Point. And we have some other projects on this list that are maybe a similar dynamic. So I'm just offering the comment that I think has been heard a few times, that the public is not necessarily, and I'm not necessarily from where I'm sitting outside of it, seeing where the pros and cons of these projects are adding up for where we're putting the dollars.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. I don't disagree with that, Commissioner. I would love to have a Steese Highway in Big Lake, so if you could arrange that, I would appreciate it. The Big Lakers, they look at the wonderful 6-lane interstate highway that they have in Fairbanks that basically goes to Fairbanks, and they would love to see that in Big Lake. No, I'm just kidding. But I do have a question about Cascade Point, and you said earlier about the Gold Belt agreement. So is a certain amount of that the fact that Gold Belt is still involved in this public-private partnership and it has some sort of return on investment? I mean, that's granted, it's not a safety project, and of course we all know that those should take precedence as much as they possibly can. But at this in this particular case. Seems to me we've established a public-private partnership with some funding coming from Gold Belt to a road that has a return on investment eventually for our children for a various number of reasons. So maybe we can explore that a little bit if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aisha, Representative McCabe. Yeah, our relationship with Gold Belt, it's a partnership. You know, they are the majority landholders in the area, and they have development plans. You know, for us as the state, I mean, the ferry terminal is a separate piece of infrastructure that would be run by the state, run by AMHS, and move forward like that. There's this recognition that, I mean, there's opportunities there for economic development. Some of those, you know, bigger picture state focus areas, you know, as we, you know, invest in the area. And so that's where you see the state of Alaska, you know, investing in an area that, yeah, for a good purpose.
Thanks.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair. First, Commissioner, thank you both, Ms. Keith and Commissioner, for coming. I know it's always a little daunting and a little nerve-wracking to come before this committee, and so we always appreciate when you do come because you're always very kind and very gentle. But I guess the question that begs to be asked that has not been asked, and Commissioner, I heard you use the term priority, exactly whose priority is Cascade Point? It is not the surrounding villages. They have sent resolutions to this body saying they don't want a ferry system out there. It's too far out. They can't get to the shopping. They don't want to depend on this, that, or the other thing. It has split Juneau. The majority of people in Juneau are not interested in it. But yet there's, what, $28 million, and we have ferry facilities in communities that already exist that are falling apart. It would seem to me that that money would be much better spent on existing infrastructure. We're having a new Tustamina built, and so I guess the question I would like to ask it: whose priority is this?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Aisha, Representative Stutes. Well, you know, for a few of those things, I would just like to say the Tustamina we advertised last week for construction. And that's huge for the state of Alaska. So we've got that one. We have 12 or 13 ferry docks that we currently, I mean, we have the funding in the Rural Ferry Program. It's secured. They're going through that design process so we can certify them and get them built. I mean, so we're making good strides in that. When it comes to the Cascade Point, you know, from the department perspective, we recognize, I mean, the Alaska Marine Highway System and operating costs is something that's an important piece of the puzzle and how we can, if there's any opportunities to reduce operating costs, we should be looking at that. We're taking steps to do that. That was something that was in the long-range plan as identified as a priority. That specific project wasn't identified, you know, as a priority in that plan, but that concept of, you know, if we can extend the roads, you know, have the shorter ferry runs and be able to, you know, reduce those operating costs as a long-term, you know, sustainability for the Alaska Marine Highway System, I mean, that's how we're looking at it. That's what makes it important for us.
And I appreciate that response. But the Alaska Marine Highway is here to service Alaskans. It's not for any other reason. It's not to make money. It won't ever make money. You know that, Commissioner. You know, it's just like our roads. And you're talking about the operational costs. That's another big issue. Our federal dollars are going to run out. They've been using money that wasn't intended for operations. So to take these funds and start a whole new project when you can't afford what is, or we can't hardly afford what already exists, is hard for me to understand.
Yeah, through Chair, Co-Chair, I shadow Representative
Stutes. Just giving wait times. if there was a response.
Yeah, and I, you know, and we are working with FTA, you know, and on that, you know, federal fund issue that's you know, we're currently looking at. So these things are all in the works. I mean, the department has been very active. I mean, we're going to Washington, D.C. We're beating down the streets, you know, on all these things. It's really trying to make the most of it for whatever we can find. And I think, I mean, if you just go look back in a couple years, I mean, there has been good progress made in the Lascar Marine Highway System. You know, I think Director Torga has done just a phenomenal job. Our uptime was 98.5% for 2024 and 2025. You know, I think we're on a good track here. So this, you know, the Cascade Point piece is part of that plan.
I have one more coming.
Follow up.
Thank you. My last comment is going to be, I appreciate that. And I agree. I think that the Marine Highway System Commissioner has come a long way in the last few years. But if you look back 12 years, this administration's number one objective was to get rid of the Alaska Marine Highway. So I do give you kudos for their operations that they currently have and how you've pushed forward and with Mr. Torga, who has done a fabulous job. So don't think that I don't see how far you've come, but it's just disconcerting to see the way some of the dollars are expended. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, yeah, we're not – I know this is kind of highways and STIP and everything else, but I do – as long as we're on the ferry system, which I love the ferries. But – so we have a number of ferries that are really, really, really old, right? The Tusty being one. That I mean, it was the Rusty Tusty when I first rode it in 1980, and it's just gotten rustier, I think. I think Representative Stutz told me that the captain inspects every weld on the ship before he sails it every time. So we needed to replace it. We've got a couple more in the pipeline that are going to need to be replaced. So I think what I hear you're saying is if we can save money by asking Alaskans to drive all the way out to Cascade Point, heaven forbid, that we would have to drive a little extra to save us some money so we would have the money available to the ferry to buy new ferries eventually. It seems to me that that kind of makes financial sense. Are we thinking that long range?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative McCabe. Yeah, I think that's what the long-range plan that the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board, you know, contributed to and was approved, that's what it says. And there's a plan in there for replacing the vessels. I mean, there's some challenges there because of the high cost. I mean, we're estimating the Tustamina at about $300 million, you know, to get that one replaced. So, yeah, but there's a plan there for how we would replace the vessels and keep the Alaska Marine Highway System moving, yeah.
Thanks.
And then I think you just have a final thank you slide, if
that's correct.
Yeah.
That ends our presentation. Thank you.
So thank you. Is there any final comments? Yes, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eisenhardt. My apologies. Can we go back to slide 10? I wanted to clarify something on slide 10 just related to the FHWY funding. So I saw that under the surface transportation for federal fiscal year 2026, FHWA formula programs, that's $966 million, correct? And then going back to slide 4, if we may. On slide 4, those FHWA funds in 2025, without the August redistribution, it's a little under $800 million. And so for those federal fiscal year 2026 funds, seems like a big difference of about $200 million. So on slide 10, is that including August reappropriation, or how are you covering for that difference?
Yeah, through Co-Chair Eichheit, Representative Mina. On slide 10, this dollar amount is all available revenue that we have in that year. Some of it is new appropriations that came in during the fiscal year. Some is what goes from and carries over from federal fiscal year 25 into federal fiscal year 26. So the slide here has this cumulative revenue that's available, everything available to us in this fiscal year. Going back to the earlier slide 4, you know, that shows a bit more of a obligation by year dollar amount less than available, different than available revenue for that year. So it would be great for us to have a year that we had $966 million in available revenue and then we could expend that amount. But because matching fund types with projects doesn't always line up that cleanly, there will always be some carryover given our reduced limitation when compared to our revenue amount. So
thank you for the clarification.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a good catch.
I had help. It wasn't just me.
Any other final questions or comments before I say something nice towards our guest? Seeing none, I just really appreciate the three of you. You know, I think you get asked a lot of tough questions, and it's because folks care about their state. Folks care about our infrastructure. We want to maximize the utility of limited resources. So I just want you to know that I appreciate you all. You have a hard job, and I just hope you stick with it and keep coming to our meetings, and I appreciate you. And then I have just a little closing statement, but I would like to, you know, dismiss our guests, but I always like to give my co-chair the last word before I bring us home. Co-chair Carrie.
Thank you. I just want to thank our guests for being here, and I'd like to keep the dialogue going as much as we can this session, despite having some, you know, moments where we're asking hard questions and critical conversations. We're doing it on behalf of all the people we all collectively serve. So I really appreciate the conversation today. It's extremely helpful. And please let us know how we can better partner the department as we go forward. The match discussion is super important today, and I think the legislature stands ready to partner with the department on getting this across the finish line. But just ask for that help. Continue to ask us for that help, because we're here, we're ready, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. And then just for the public's awareness, we're about ready to wrap up, but this is a topic that we continue to engage on. Transportation Committee and the other body had a similar hearing last week, Thursday, if folks want to look at that. Of course, this subject was a part of a Senate Finance Committee meeting this morning, so I'm just referencing that for folks. And we did add some additional documents to basis that came out last minute from Ledge Legal on this issue, but it was a robust conversation, and we thank you. The next House Transportation Committee meeting will be this Thursday, January 29th, at 1 o'clock p.m. in this room, room 124. On Thursday, we'll have a presentation on winter road maintenance, which is appropriate given what's happening in Anchorage right now in South Central.
Go back to Anchorage and take some
from Legislative Liaison Andy Mills and DOT and PF staff. We'll hear our first bill of the legislative session, House Bill 216, Transfer of Railroad Land to Whittier, and hear invited testimony. So, with that, we adjourn this meeting at 2:59 p.m.